Welcome to the Misophonia Podcast. You're listening to episode 4 of season 3. My name is Adil Mott, and I have misophonia. This week I have our first guest from Ireland. Claire has lived on both sides of the Atlantic, but is now back home in Ireland. I think you'll be able to tell this was a fun conversation. She actually comes from a large family of misophones, which you'll hear about. She has tons of tips she uses for dealing with miso that you're going to want to hear, and some great stories about dealing with miso at work, like the sniffling woman and the bull-banging man. Great stuff. About 7 minutes in through my usual mic, I was having problems, so I switched over to AirPods, so you might notice a difference. Not as good, but still works. I have a whole bunch of interviews going on via text, message, and DMs. A little too many at the moment because they're so good and I want to focus on fewer at a time. But please hit me up on Instagram at Misophonia Podcast or on Twitter at Misophonia Show if you're interested in doing, you know, non-audio text-based interviews. The new website will be up shortly with all of these. All right, so without further ado, here is my conversation with Claire. Yeah, then I guess I'll just jump into it. Claire, welcome to the podcast. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Adil.
And so let's tell the listeners where you're from. Get that out of the way.
Yeah, I am from Ireland, a city called Cork, right down in the south of Ireland. I don't know, have you heard of it?
You know, actually, Cork. Yeah, I think one of my neighbors across the street. He's got relatives up in Cork. He's mentioned that a number of times. Sounds like a great place.
It is. It's great. Not everybody knows it. People will, you know, usually know Dublin, but it's the second biggest city in Ireland, right down in the south.
Okay, cool.
And I moved home last year after 14 years away in London and New York. So it is so lovely to be back. An absolute delight. I love being back in Cork.
That's great. And was that, I guess, so yeah, I also like to find out kind of what people do for work. I guess you were you kind of traveling around for work mainly?
I worked in finance. So I first did a decade in London working in equities. And then I had the opportunity to move to New York and transfer with my company. So I did that in 2015 and it was absolutely incredible. And actually that's, of course, America is so good at being, you know, progressive and doing things ahead of other countries. And that's where I went to my first misophonia convention. Now, as I say that, I went to the one in Minnesota a couple of years ago. As I say that, I realize I should probably tell you something first, which is that when I first realized that it was a thing, that there was a name for it, I was in my mid-20s. And I found it online and in my head pronounced it misophonia. And that told my family and everything. We've all had that moment where it's illuminating. And then years later, like literally 10 years later, I go to the convention in Minnesota. I'm sitting there and Dr. Marsha Johnson is making the opening remarks. And two things happened. The first was I felt completely overwhelmed because it was just this acknowledgement of it, you know, and everyone in this room collectively acknowledging it, like it being real. And I felt sort of tears coming into my eyes and I was like, oh my God. And then I was like, Claire, get your shit together. Oh God, sorry, I shouldn't curse, should I?
No, it's fine. Yeah.
Okay. I was like, get yourself together, because if I start to cry, I'll start to sniffle and then I'll have to remove myself from the convention. But the second thing that happened was that all of a sudden I was like, oh my God, it's not pronounced misophonia. And I've told everyone that it's pronounced misophonia. Right. I mean, we just call it my miso in the family.
Hey, whatever works.
Yeah. So I have since tried to correct it, but there's so much muscle memory from calling it miso that might happen on the podcast. So I realize that's quite the tangent to have started off on. But anytime I speak, I'm going to be tempted to say miso, so I may as well just get it
That's
out there.
That's probably the least of our auditory worries. Don't worry about that. We'll get into, I'm sure, much nastier things to listen to. But I just want to say I was in that room too. And so that was my first convention. I'm actually here in St. Paul. So I was the Minnesota convention was my first one. And I had all the same feelings. You know, it's just like it was intense. It was like I was trying to, I could feel that everyone's trying not to kind of like lose their ass. And yeah, I was right there. Someone there feeling the same thing, so that's amazing.
It was an insane moment. It really was.
I went to the one last year in Denver, which is actually what inspired the podcast. I started like the week after I came back, because I bumped into the same people, and that kind of confirmed that just talking about this stuff with others is
It's so therapeutic. Because it's such a funny thing with the condition. I never know what to refer to it as, actually. But it's that it's so quirky. You know, there's consistencies in terms of how people suffer and what the triggers are. But it's such a lawless sort of condition at times, where you know you'll have explained to someone, say new who's learning about it, how it works, and then you might be out with them and they'll say, but why isn't that annoying you now? and it's because there's so many sort of environmental factors that can influence it, or how you know how much sleep you've had, all these small little things that make it really difficult for other people to understand how, oh, 1 minute it can be fine and another minute it can't, and oh, a noisy room is actually okay now. And I find it super therapeutic to listen to some of the guests that you've had on and just find it so relatable, you know, just normalizes it, you know.
How far back does it go for you? I'd love to hear about also eventually I've never had somebody from international high finance on the podcast. So I'm thinking, the TV show Billions and Boiler Room and stuff like that. So,
funny. So we're jumping right now.
I jump around all the time. Question. I just said two things. Yeah.
So your first question was the earliest.
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah.
And for that, do you know, after listening to a number of your other guests, and actually I picked this up a little bit at the convention as well, I realized I was really lucky because I did not get onset at a young age of 6 or 7. It was definitively my teenage years. And for that, it meant I really only had a few years in secondary school, so yeah, high school for you guys, and then college in that environment where, because I recognized that the challenges of that environment where you're young, you can't control it, you have to stay in the classroom, you know? So I thankfully, yeah, the onset was, I guess, my teenage years, and it was the classic, people eating. And funny enough, it was actually a couple of girlfriends in school where I really noticed it. And I know normally it's the family environment first. And yeah. I've been thinking about this. I wonder, was I slightly shielded from the aggressive fight or flight trigger because I grew up in a classic Irish big family, so all meal times were loud anyway, you know?
Or there was some
argument going on, or
right?
I mean, I don't know. For sure, my siblings and my parents all trigger me. But I just don't remember getting as intense a fight or flight at that age, at that time. It happened with school friends first, and then obviously it escalated over time with my family as well. My only theory for that is that it was such a loud environment that it didn't allow for the obvious.
Maybe you just always had background noise at house, at the house or something.
I mean, it was chaotic.
Yeah, it's interesting. And then at school, it's probably like, okay, you gotta like focus. And
in particular, now to be fair, there wasn't really much eating during class or anything that went on in school. Right. But it started with like lunches I'd go to with my friends, and there was one girl that would clash her teeth off of the cutlery or the silverware, as you say. And I just remember that was like a really, really early one where I just couldn't handle it at all. And then I remember one time, and I tried to explain it, but I didn't have the words to explain it, or, you know, I didn't know what it was. But I had tried in some way to explain that this was something that really annoyed me. And I thought, oh God, teenage girls. I remember at one point she took me aside and explained to me how it really hurt her, how I couldn't find a way to eat with her, you know, things like that, and all the drama of it. But yeah, so then through college, it was similar. It was primarily all around eating noises and sniffling. And then, as we all know, just over time, through my 20s, added lots of triggers. And of course, then I went into an open plan office environment, which
finance money throwing around everywhere.
I don't know if you remember this from the Minnesota convention, but Dr. Johnson, she said at one point that it brings a whole new meaning to the phrase familiarity breeds contempt. Resonated with me so much, because, you know, In the London office in particular, we sometimes do these seat rotations just to mix things up, or if we'd had new people hired. And, you know, I'd always be so excited by it, because unless someone's a definitive trigger person when you first meet them, like, you know, you just know even by the look of them that they're going to be a trigger person. But some people, they fly under the radar, and it is this whole familiarity breeds contempt, where you sit beside them, you're like, oh, this is great, she's a delight, oh, she doesn't make noise when she eats, all this. And then, you know, months later, you're like, why does she keep curling her hair like that? And then I would learn to recognize it too, where I'd notice something, and then I think to myself, oh no, here we go, because I knew it was about to be, you know, filed away, that my brain has caught it and added that to the list. But I will say now, to be fair, the first few years of working in London in the open plan office, and it was I worked on quite a small trade floor. That was definitely challenging. And in part because I still didn't know that it was a thing. So it was a particular day at work when, I don't know if I was particularly tired or hungover or something, but the guy that sat beside me came back to his desk with a load of food, and I just lost the plot. And I just got my things, walked out of the office, got the tube home, at the subway home, sat in my apartment, and I was just like, this is not normal. Like, this is not normal that I cannot function. And I just started randomly Googling things, and that's when it came up.
So you basically
had a panic attack,
basically. Yeah.
I was just like, this can't be normal. And it's so interesting now, because when I think back on that, I guess I was around 25 or 26 at the time. And I think I'm hopeful at least that the generation coming up, that they won't ever have to wait that long to learn, because at that time there wasn't any smartphones or anything, or we hadn't gotten to this sort of habit of, you know, any thought or question we have these days, you can just throw it into Google, you know, no thought goes unanswered or question goes unanswered. Whereas this was a case of, you know, I went home and I opened up my laptop and tried to do some research, you know. And it was, oh my God, I mean, I've heard people on your podcast talk about that moment where you learn it's a thing. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's just, I know. But you can't stop. You can't stop researching it. You're just basically up all night.
I found it actually. First thing I did was tell my family, because I have four siblings, and we're a family of seven in total, and my dad has it, and.
Oh. Okay.
Of the siblings, four of the five of us have it.
Wow. Okay.
I know. Lest there be any doubt that there's a genetic trait going on, like, it's definitely five of the seven family members. Now, the only thing is that mine is by far the most severe. So
do they all still have it, or and it's just a lower level? Okay,
just a lower level.
I was just talking to somebody else on an upcoming for an upcoming episode, and she said, I mean, you'll hear it actually probably a little bit before yours, but she still has it hardcore. Like hers went up, and her brother's went down. They both had it around the same time at at the age of 7 or 8, and his is practically gone. Hers kind of kept going. And her dad, their dad had it too, and this is kind of where we're just kind of like speculating on things like whether, you know, the whole nature versus nurture, and maybe hers is a little bit more, you know, maybe this, we're just totally speculating, but like maybe hers
is
a little bit more genetically, and his was more instilled because, you know, I'm sure their dad kind of like
because he picked up on things.
Yeah,
that's so interesting.
That's why,
because I've never heard of someone going down. I mean,
no, I know. That's like a...
Someone should analyze his brain.
We need to like surround him at the next convention. But it's interesting. So yeah, because you said that you don't really notice it getting triggered when you were growing up. And lo and behold, like your whole family basically has it. What did you notice? I'm just curious what you noticed growing up. Did you notice it at all? Or was everyone just kind of like...
I guess it was more the first triggers where I noticed a fight or flight. I just remember being more the school ones, but it was in very quick succession, and that it would have crept into the family environment as well. And it was all the eating noises again. So we'd have fights over that. And then because I'm one of the older ones, I would have moved. I left Ireland after college and went to London. So there wasn't as much time, I guess, where I was being triggered all the time by my siblings, especially because the two youngest ones would have been properly like kids who tend to trigger me less. But when I was leaving home. Now, it's very different today because we're all adults today. So today, you know, if we have a family dinner, then they are very good. It's like Claire's my zone. Now, they're good also because they do actually understand it.
Yeah, this is amazing. I mean,
yeah.
This is like a...
So they don't have it as aggressively, but they are so patient and accommodating. You know, if, we'll have music on if there's if we're having dinner together, or if we're going out to dinner. You know, where does Claire need to sit type thing. And in this cruel twist of fate, so I have quite a lot of visual triggers, and my mom does not stop moving, God love her. One trick that we have is, say, you know, with a family of seven, or if all of us are out together, that if I sit on the same side as my mom and have someone in between us, then I don't see the visual triggers. You know, if we're on the same side of the dinner table. And then if I'm one person away from her. So yeah, they're very common.
I totally understand that calculation. Yeah. We've all done that.
Yeah.
Don't be in my field of vision and no one will get hurt.
Exactly. But no, they're good. And even like recently we had a little night away for my, just the females of the family for my mum's birthday, and my youngest sister, we were figuring out what way we would carpool, and she said to me, oh, look, you know, my hay fever is a bit bad at the moment. And so it was a combination of her not wanting to stress me by, you know, sniffling, but also her not wanting to be stressed by not being able to sniffle because of her hay fever.
Right.
So she said, look, no, I'll drive up on my own. And I was like, okay, great. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
It definitely does help. During lockdown, I lived with my other younger sister, and I even noticed that we're very open with each other. Then, you know, we'd be like, oh, do you mind not doing that? Oh God, yeah, sorry, because we both understand it. And then sometimes you'd watch a movie, and we'd both have a little bit of chocolate, and like I can tell that, you know, we're both just letting the chocolate melt in our mouths.
Yeah. Does that help? I mean, even though you're doing things that trigger, does it maybe help just knowing that at least the other person is sympathetic? Yes. Does it reduce the stress level, right? I mean, it's like because a lot of it, it's just the fear that something is going to happen. And that's I think a lot of what the visual is about. It's just like,
yes,
you know.
It's 100% worse if you've the fear that a trigger is coming, or if you feel that you're in an environment where you can't not control it, but be open with the person you're with. You know, that you can't ask them to make an accommodation, which I know is hard over time. I mean, it's like I struggle with that, with constantly asking people to make compromises. But I would say that I have found the most positive aspect was telling more and more people. I mean, obviously, like friends and family, but that's really helped, because if they're your friends and family, they do want to help and they do want to be supportive. So I think that's been really, really helpful for me over time, even in the workplace, actually. As soon as I understood that it was a thing, I think that really empowered me as well to, rather than hide away from it, to actually be more vocal about it. And
I'd like to hear about that, because stereotypical, but your work environment, I'm visualizing pretty intense, maybe also very kind of male oriented, just type A kind of environment. So it's like, talking about these kinds of things, is this like, did you feel comfortable, you know, they're just normal doing that? Are people receptive, or is it?
So I was a lot better at it in New York. So I would say that when I moved to the New York office, that was our headquarters, and it was a proper big trade floor. And that was a much easier environment, because it's almost like the restaurant thing, as long as you're not focusing on one specific noise, I know, but having just a noisy backdrop is actually helpful, because it does muffle things. London was more challenging, because it was a smaller trade floor, and actually for a trade floor, it was quite quiet sometimes, or not sometimes, like it just wasn't noisy all the time. Definitely, we moved offices at one point, and I just couldn't. I was just so devastated, because, you know, everyone, you're on the trade floor from early in the morning, so everyone would eat at their desks, like breakfast included. And when we moved to offices, they had proper, like not plastic plates and spoons and things. It was proper crockery. I was like, you have got to be kidding me. Everyone's going to be around me eating their cereal in the morning. And so I would try to, just little tricks that I learned over time. So sometimes in the morning, you know, when the research comes out and so I was in sales, you'd go through the research and then you'd prepare your email or for your client calls. So I would often just put in earphones. So I love brown noise in particular, because I find it more soothing than, or less harsh than white. So I would do that and try and time it around when people would be eating their cereal, or I'd choose that time to go out and get a coffee, or just little sort of protective measures. And then I was lucky enough to, I sat beside two close friends in the office and I told them, and they were very supportive. And also the girl I sat beside, who's still one of my closest friends, is just a very minimal trigger person. So I definitely got lucky there. Mm-hmm. But there has been so many instances. Like there was one woman that sat across me for ages and wouldn't stop sniffling. And at one point I just remember like standing up really aggressively and like passing over a box of tissue and be like, Angela, do you need a tissue? And she like looked up at me innocently, because you know you can get really worked up in your head thinking she's doing it on purpose. She knows it's
course.
She's definitely doing it on purpose. And then there was another instance. So this actually was one that made me tell more people, because there was a guy that would really aggressively bang on his bowl. And I just remember one day, and he would sit with his back to me. I remember one day he was doing it when he was eating, and I just swiveled around my chair just to give him the glare. you know, yes, just because even though it won't stop it, I just had to give him the dagger, you know?
Yeah, of course.
And I did that in the safety of, I know he sits with his back to me as well.
Oh, and okay.
Yes. In that moment, he swiveled his chair around to talk to someone and literally caught me bang on with my dagger eye glare. And so he, I said, I don't know if it's like a type A thing or a male thing, but he basically was like, what the F? And immediately, like, messages me on, you know, the internal work chat. I was like, okay, I've had enough. What the hell was that? And I was like, oh my God. So I apologized and I just said, just let me explain. And then I tried to explain a little bit what it was and then find like a link. I often link to something if I'm telling someone so that they can, you know, it also makes it real. I think if you can show an official website or something, you know?
Yeah.
And, and he wrote me back the nicest message because he said he was just so relieved because of course I give out the dagger eyes all the time, but I don't think people notice that much. Mm-hmm. And in the morning meeting when we'd all sit around a table and hear the research of the day, I remember he would, if I don't know if I should describe it in detail, but it was something about when he would drink his cup of coffee with the lid on. So he wrote me this message about how his wife is actually called Claire. And he was like, Claire, this is such a relief to understand this. I've been telling my wife, Claire, at home that there's this Claire in the office that hates me and I don't know why. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And he said, is this why you give me these evil looks in the morning meeting as well? And I was like, oh my God. And then I realized how, okay, turns out not so subtle with my dagger eyes. And then I explained about the coffee cup. And after that, if we were in the morning meeting together, he'd look over at me, take the lid off his coffee cup and put it down beside the cup and just drink without the lid. And I was just like, you're such a good guy. And but it just changed our relationship completely because sometimes I don't know if this happens to you. Sometimes it can really muddy the water sometimes between if someone's a trigger person and then I'm like, I just don't like them. I also don't like them.
Yeah.
especially if they're like not someone I'm that close to, you know? And now I get to really like him. So that was just a really telling moment for me where I was like, okay, you have to tell more people because people are okay making small accommodations. Like it was no skin off his back, you know, to take the lid off the coffee cup. And yet it made such a world of difference to me. So it was really good for that to happen, actually. And it empowered me to tell more people then. So I would say that it was, to answer your original question, so London was definitely more challenging because it was a bit quieter. But I was lucky with where I sat and I would tell more people. And then in New York, definitely the bigger trade floor was better. And we went back to people ate out of paper plates and things from the canteen. So that was a relief as well. But of course, you know, this all the little group that I sat beside on the trade floor, over time I had to tell them. But they were, you know, they became my close friends. So you'd laugh about it. Like I'd go to a meeting and come back and one of like Meredith would be, oh, we had a crisp party while you were gone, Claire.
Right. It sounds like you've had like really good luck. Well, not just good luck. I mean, you've kind of spearheaded it, but you've been able to communicate with people and really change your environment. You know, obviously sounds like obviously after it took some work, but you got.
I was about to say, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
It's been the depths of despair moment.
Oh yeah, we know that.
Because I definitely have I know I'm high up on the scale, especially I have a lot of visual, but and actually having long hair helps as a female because I find that if I put my, you know, it can protect me from the peripheral vision if I keep my hair down.
Oh, okay. I thought you'd just say you shove hair into your ears so that you can't hear.
No. So earphones in the ears. But then if I have my hair down, it can protect me a little bit as well. So no, I do. Yeah, for sure. It's been super challenging over the years in the office environments, but I just, you learn tricks of the trade. If I think telling people really, really helps. And I think I've been lucky with the people I've sat near as well. I've been really lucky that they've become friends, and then it's easier then to tell them as well. There was one insane trigger person in the New York office.
Yes.
Everything about him was a trigger. And there was a plan to do a seat move. And they wanted to put him beside me so that I could sort of mentor him and things like that. And basically, I thought of another logical reason why it didn't make sense, why I wanted to put another member of our team in between us. Mm-hmm. And then I had a friend of mine in the office speak to the head guy and reinforce that view. And so we sort of between us sort of navigated it. But I think at that point, if they had put him sitting beside me, I would have then had to go to my boss and actually say, look, actually, no, you can't. Right. And Meredith was like, she will resign if you put him sitting beside her. I think I've learned how to navigate it. And that's, I guess, what I would try to encourage people as well to try to, as much as they can, instill that sort of control over their environment and tell people and see it. Because I really haven't met that many bad apples that have been super dismissive of it. So
yeah, that's the one thing.
People are intrigued, you know, they might be like throw their eyes to heaven or just think, or maybe they say stuff behind my back, I don't know. But for the most part, you know, I think people are generally supportive. I've been lucky in that respect as well. What I'm hopeful as well is that that there are some silver linings with COVID in terms of everyone who's been able to work from home has worked from home, and hopefully that will mean that employers will be more open and flexible so that people with misophonia will be able to go to their bosses post-COVID and, you know, whether they want to tell them that they have a condition or not, at least their employers should be more open to a more flexible work environment. And I think that would probably take the edge off as well.
Absolutely. And you don't have to be home like 5 days a week, but I think if you have at least the option to be like you took off that one day or even if it's like a fixed schedule of like, you know, a couple of days a week or something, I think that could really, like you said, just take the edge off the rest of the time, where you could be like, all right, at least I don't have to be here tomorrow to deal with Jack, who I'm going to murder if he...
his name was Jack. Did I say that?
Oh,
I don't think I mentioned his name. No.
You mentioned someone to people, I don't even know which Jack you're talking about. Oh, the real, the one who was about to get mentored, quote unquote, by you. Right.
What was I going to say? Oh, yeah, and actually I work from home now, which is amazing.
Yeah.
As in, irrespective of COVID. I moved back to Ireland, and so the company I work for actually had an office in Dublin, which they sort of put on the table or suggested, would that be something I would be interested in? Because I wanted to move back home. That's why the primary reason I left New York was to move back to Cork. So Dublin is not commutable with Cork. So I unfortunately just had to say no. And I wanted to take some time off, so I took a year off. And then this job came up with the firm where I can work from home in Cork. And in a post-COVID world, I will do some days out of the Dublin office as well. But for the most part, my job will be working from home in Cork, which is, I can't even tell you, it's a delight.
And is it the same company that you've been working with for a while?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
That's great. I mean, that's a great lesson for other misophones. Like, you know, if you can find a good company that's making strides or making strides to help, hang on to them and don't burn any bridges. And then you're able to do things like take a year off or and then come back and with in a pretty kind of accommodative situation, I guess.
For sure. It's been, I actually have to keep pinching myself. I only started back work with them in the summer, and I would, wake up and sit down at my desk some mornings and just smile. Like, how did I pull this off? You know, I get to live in Cork and still work for them. So that's been a huge positive.
Yeah. Another thing is that, a lot of people, I talk to people who are pretty young, maybe still in school, or just out of school. And, one of the big lessons is like, you think it does get better, especially if you're able to create the environment.
I couldn't agree with you more. I couldn't, in fact, so in some of your more recent podcasts, I felt like, so now I'm getting ahead of myself because it's sort of like the signing off question that you ask people. Is there any sort of message you want to leave them with or whatever? And that is like the big thing I really want to say to any younger person suffering is that it definitely gets easier. And it just gets easier because in part, I think the way just sometimes growing up can get easier. You know, you just get a bit more self-confidence or, you're not riddled with insecurities like you are in your teenage years. But you have more confidence to tell people and you do gain more control over your environment. It is really only in a sort of school college setting that you're sort of locked into these classrooms. And then with a workplace, there are accommodations that can be made. There is working from home. Look, it's never going to be everything. I mean, meetings can be an absolute nightmare or, lunch meetings. Don't even get me started because in America, they love to throw chips in with all lunch meetings.
I hate eating with my coworkers. I don't know why. I can
that's
love
brutal.
Coworkers, but
it definitely does get easier. And I think you just learn more little tricks or more ways to cope as well.
What are some of yours? So obviously, you've got super long hair, it sounds like. And besides being like a Chewbacca kind of situation?
I know. I know that I look like an absolute crazy person when I'm on a plane. Because when I'm on a plane, I will have earbuds in and then the overhead headphones. And then I'll have a hoodie up. So that get rid of the peripheral vision, and
that's great. When you don't
hoodies
have long
are
hair.
Great.
Yeah,
hoodies are great. But I just know that I look absolutely, like, totally like a maniac. Coping mechanisms. I've heard you say this before, actually, and it was something I picked up from the convention, which it sounds so simple, but I do think really helps to decompress before you enter a potential trigger situation. Mm-hmm. Because I remember it was in one of the little breakout sessions we were talking about this, about how you can walk around full of tension and braced, braced for a trigger. And sure, that's just a terrible position to put your body in, and also it means you really will jump when that trigger comes, like your whole body, like I'm doing it now even as I say it. And I found that just that little tip of actually before you walk into the office at work, just take a few deep breaths. It does allow you to cope with a little bit better. I have a great little CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, trick that someone gave me as well before, which is which helps to wind yourself down. So sometimes I even do it after work if I've had like a bit of like an adrenaline boost from work. That if wherever you're sitting, just take a moment and think of five things you can feel. So, I feel like my foot on the ground or whatever. Like, so five things you can feel, four things you can see, three things you can hear, two things you can smell and one thing you can taste. And you run through that exercise in your mind. And because the reason that I find it helpful as well is breathing techniques, sometimes my mind won't sit still when I'm trying to calm it. Right. And I find that sometimes it just doesn't work that well. Whereas this exercise, for some reason, because you're being forced to focus on the 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 things, it actually just works quite effectively at winding down your brain. Or at least it works for me. So yeah, that's another little trick that I use. I've tried everything though. I've tried the CBD oil, which I don't know if it works or not, but I think the placebo effect works.
So it does, you find it does?
I find it does, yeah. I'll do that before even something, say like, you know, we get together quite often as a family. We're all based in Cork. Mm-hmm. And before a family event, because of course your family are major trigger people, I'll take the CBD oil. So that, yeah, I use that a little bit. And so those are sort of the more not practical, but the sort of decompressing CBD oil ones. Obviously I use headphones all the time. Do you know, I tried the, did you see at the convention, they had the hearing aid?
So I did
the trial on that actually, because I was curious. But I gave them back afterwards, and the reason why they worried me a little bit was because I don't like the idea of having too permanent a crutch in my ear, because then when I take it out, everything's amplified, you know?
That's exactly my concern, yeah.
Yeah. So I will always have my earphones with me, you know, my wireless ones or earbuds or the overhead ones, but I will try to only put them in when I need to have them in, so that I don't become this person that constantly has earphones in. Yeah. So, and brown noise I think is great. And then what other little tricks? Oh, like family dinners, things like that. Or even when I go call over to my parents and just catching up and having a cup of tea, I'll just, the first thing I'll do when I go into the kitchen is we'll put music on. And then
death metal always, and
I know all sadly know it my mom will love a bit of like classical or if it's Frank Sinatra, so we just have to ramp up the volume. And then so always have packed the tissues with you, so then you can offer someone a tissue if they sneeze. And actually it's very interesting in our family, like my siblings definitely are milder than me, but all of our households, if you walk into any of them, there's packets of tissues all around the different rooms.
Nice.
Yeah. So yeah.
Just grab it before it starts and do your business and then we can talk. So yeah.
Exactly. So that's another little one. Do you know what I miss actually? Because there really isn't that much sushi in Ireland. And I found that sushi restaurants were great because, I mean, I know you, there's sometimes the little bit of soup, the
udon and
Well, no, but if, so God, no, I'd stay completely away from that. But if you have a pure sushi restaurant where people are ordering just sushi, then it removes the silverware and the clanging because everyone has chopsticks.
Just wooden chopsticks,
yeah,
and you're not really cutting stuff up, you're just kind of basically tossing fish in your mouth, and it's
and nothing makes a lot of noise. Exactly. Food. So I do miss that because I found that that was a good one. But that's a good tip for people if they have to do lunch meetings. Like I would have to sometimes do client lunch meetings, and I would just, the default was always to do sushi.
Do sushi and make sure nobody orders miso soup.
No miso soup.
Tell the restaurant, no complimentary miso soup.
Exactly.
I'll tip you extra if you don't bring any goddamn complimentary miso soup.
You gotta find the way. But you know what? It's another interesting little COVID silver lining. And look, don't get me wrong, I know there's so much devastation with COVID, but we'll take our wins. And I would say that working from home is one, especially because there could be sort of longer term positive implications from that. Also, we've gone back into a bit more restrictions here in Ireland at the moment, but over the summer when we'd eased things up, you'd go out to dinner and there was more spacing between tables, you know, in restaurants.
Yeah.
And then also, because everyone has to wear masks, people can't walk around stores like chomping on food. And like there's just less people publicly eating as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I find like there's these little nice miso or miso friendly COVID silver linings.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We should start making a list of it. I hadn't thought about some of those, but those are interesting things that, you know, people are talking about, like less handshaking and all this stuff. These are a lot of miso friendly habits that, that may continue.
Mm-hmm.
Which would be great.
Even like you don't see people if they're chewing gum and things like that.
Right. And spacing between,
Tables. Yeah.
Other than your family, have you bumped into many people who have been like, oh, I have that too?
I have.
It sounds like you're talking about this all the time. So
I have diagnosed many people as well. But I, you know, funnily enough, two of my really close friends have it by complete coincidence. So it was actually one of my best friends from college. When I started telling her, I don't even think it was in college when I would have told her. She might would have known I had maybe noticed the funny thing about eating, but it was when we moved to London. She had also moved to London. What she noticed was that she said her sister was the same, her younger sister, who I'd met a few times. And now her younger sister is also one of my closest friends, and she has it as well. And so I diagnosed her, but she has sometimes slightly different triggers to me. And she definitely isn't as open. I think people have to, I know, cope with it in different ways. Yeah, mine is definitely the more open, the better. Okay. Whereas I have found this, I think even with my dad is the same, where, you know, if you don't talk about it, it doesn't exist as much or something. There's, you know, and not that they're in denial, but there is a more of a if I don't acknowledge it, it's not as big or something.
Can I stereotype the old Irish kind of, I don't know, British, Irish, whatever, old school white kind of country. Yeah.
Yeah, the sort of stoic
Catholic, whatever. Yeah.
Defiance about it. Because actually it is funny with my dad one time, because I didn't want to sort of push him on it, like, I mean, I definitely know a bunch of his triggers, but I do remember at one point saying to him, you know, do you have visual ones as well? Yeah, that's like, it's like, okay.
Wow, okay, interesting. Yeah, no, he just gets it right away. Yeah,
well, yeah, because he's never he has definitely somehow found a way to sort of just swallow it a bit, because I definitely have to ask people at all times to make accommodations, whereas he wouldn't talk about it as much. And to be fair, now I know we've used the stereotype of that sort of older school Irish man, but my dad has four daughters, so he has gone a long way in being like open and talking about things. But he wouldn't ask people to make accommodations, ask it even with family members about it. He just sort of somehow is able to suck it up, but I definitely don't have that strength. I definitely have to ask people. But yeah, so back to another tangent. So really good friend of mine has it. And then another friend of mine, it was actually weirdly my first boyfriend when I was a teenager. And then Cork is really small, so we just then stayed friends all through like school and college, and we lost touch a bit in our 20s. And then he was visiting me in London at one point, and I had then since learned the name of the thing, and I was telling him about it, and then he was like, you're kidding me, I have that too. So it was just this magical moment where I was like, oh my goodness, what? And then we were like comparing like triggers and things like that. So just random coincidence, but two of my close friends have it. Oh, and I was in a relationship with someone who had it too. which again was a random coincidence. It was someone I met through work, and he was definitely milder than me, but I have to say it really helped things. It was almost like you know, say like with my family as well, where you're both aware, so you're both very understanding and accommodating. Like if he had said to me, "Oh, can you stop doing that?" I'd be like, "Oh my God, sorry." And things as well. I mean, we must have looked like freaks sometimes, because if say we were on like public transport together or on a plane, so we'd both have our headphones on and we would we'd message each other on our phones, or like I'd write him a message and show it to him, and you think if anyone is observing this, they'd be like, why can't you take off your headphones and talk to each other like normal people? But it was I think it really helped the relationship. I mean, we since broke up, but not for any sort of my funny reason, but I think it helped because I didn't have that guilt of asking someone to be making accommodations, and it didn't put any strain on things. Now, to be fair, that shouldn't discourage anyone who's dating someone that doesn't have misophonia, you know, because I've definitely had moments in the past of so I'm single now, and I've had moments of thinking, oh God, like it's not fair to ask someone to take that on, you know, but all of my friends and family that love me will always say, like, Claire, everyone has their stuff, you know, everyone has their stuff, and you at least you know what yours is, you know. Right. and it is always good just to remember that perspective as well, where the accommodations that you ask people to make, they're typically not big, you know. They can be the smallest little accommodations for them and make a world of a difference to you. So I think that's also worth bearing in mind, because it's obviously massive what's going on in our heads. But, you know, I have a friend who finds the whole thing entertaining. Like if she sees me, like my eye dart, you know, in a room to some trigger, like her favorite response is, oh my God, who is it? What is it? It's like a game. You know, instead of her being like, oh God, what's your problem now, you know, or who is it, she just finds the whole thing really entertaining. So I think, you know, we have to trust in people as well, that they're trusting the goodness of people. So yeah, I have come across a good few people, even from telling people at work, in the London office, there were a couple of people, definitely milder as well. But it's funny because once you then explain to them what it is, you know, I'd get these random emails then from one of my colleagues, like just he'd be on the train and he'd be like, Claire, you wouldn't believe what I have, you know, what's going on the train right now. And it's nice then, because you know that you've given them the name of the thing that's annoying them, and you've also given them a little outlet where they can now message you to vent about something that they've experienced. So I do think it's more prevalent than, you know, I guess at some point we realize there'll be some study on what the actual numbers are, but it's definitely
We're in the early days of this,
for sure,
in terms of research and awareness. I think we're all we're, you know, most you and I and a bunch of us are we're just kind of on the forefront, you know, just letting people know about it. By the time it's probably too late for us, you know, everyone will know about it, and the world will be a much quieter place, and we will have suffered for everybody else.
I know, I keep imagining, because there are certain situations, of course, that there's very little you can do about, for example, like a plane. And I always like imagine this world where I can get on the plane and show them this little card that says, you know, I've got misophonia. And then they'll be like, oh, cause of course, ma'am. And then like,
bring you over to this silent cubicle for
you. So imagine that would be the dream. But you're so good for raising the awareness of the with the podcast. So that's such a genius idea. I love podcasts, so thank you so much for doing it. I've had I've had thoughts myself of how I could do more, because I currently, besides telling people and diagnosing them, I'm not on any social media. I don't exist in that world at all, and would be very reluctant to. So sometimes when I listen to your podcast, I feel a little bit guilty that I should be trying to do more.
Yeah, Claire, why are you so okay? No, that's totally understandable. I mean, more and more people are just kind of reclaiming their independence. But I think, yeah, I mean, wherever you are, if you can find some people that just beyond that kind of text message circle or or just kind of like meet up at a, you know, a known quiet place.
I'm gonna have a think. I definitely want to do more.
Yeah, no, I mean, this has been so good. It you know, you alluded to earlier that you'd already kind of like hit your message for the community, but is there anything else that you want to tell people about your story that you think is
I think I waffled on long enough.
Yeah, no, it has been totally gold all the way, but yeah, I'm just curious.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say.
Is there anything else you want to say?
No, I definitely wanted, because of course I've stolen my own thunder now, but it was just what I said earlier about, I do
gets
think
easier
it,
gets, and,
it, yeah. it does. I do think yeah. it improves. I do think it's an important message, because when I was at the convention in Minnesota as well, and I saw, you know, that was the first time I realized that there really was some younger folk, or that a lot of people, the onset was younger than it was for me. And I just thought that's a lot to take on when you're that age. I do think that in as much as we can to get that message out and to speak to younger kids about it, and so that they understand, because to have it so young and then to go through your teenage years with all that brings, it's super overwhelming, you know. Mm-hmm. I just really wanted to leave people with a positive message. And I think that the way the world is moving in terms of technology and flexibility, and I think it can only get better as well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say, look, I know it, there are just awful, despairing, dark moments with this thing that we all have, but it's manageable, you know. And have faith in people, I think, because I've definitely been really positively surprised by colleagues, friends, family, you know, people that I've encountered. They've for the most part been super supportive and accommodating, and so I think that's so I would really encourage people as well to be as open as they can about it.
Yeah, that's great, and I really love your tips on, like, just I always forget to do it too, but walking into a room and you know, taking deep breaths or doing mm-hmm. whatever exercise you need to do. I wonder if there's like an, I hate to bring up, you know, technology for the sake of technology, but like something like a something to kind of like buzz you or remind you to kind of every so often, or maybe it senses that things are getting loud and, you know, tell, you know, gets you to calm down or something like that. But yeah, just taking those times, if however you remember to kind of like take a breath. That's another great tip.
Yeah, and I think it's just healthy, but it's good for your body as well. Like you know, it's not nice for your body to walk around full of tension and brace mm-hmm. for something, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good, once you get into the habit of it as well, it's helpful, because you don't realize how much, your body can be tense and you can be completely unaware of it, you know, because we're so used to doing it. So just even once you start to get into the habit of it, it makes you more aware of how often you brace for things.
Yeah. It's like when you go to yoga and you have no idea how tense you are until you're like, until they keep telling you to relax. And you're like, I am relaxed.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, God. I was going to actually ask you, because you've done so many of these, and you ask everyone, I think, for, you know, their coping mechanisms. Was there any that surprised you, or is there any that's like your, you know, top tip that you would recommend?
Yeah, I need to, this is exactly what I need. This is one of the things I need to review for before the,
I'm just front running your Saturday.
So no, I mean, I need to like, I've been doing transcripts and stuff to just kind of, so I can just kind of breeze through everything, but I don't think there's anything, I mean, you had a lot of good ones today, actually. I mean, hoodies and hair blocking vision and the deep breaths. Deep breaths is when I bring up a lot. Yeah, I mean, talking about it with people, just having tons of earphones. I mean, it's nothing that we, yeah. I mean, honestly, like, I was nodding along to a lot of stuff you said, because it's like, it's the usual suspects. Yeah, plus, you know, yeah. And so there isn't anything even in terms of things people ingest or what, or CBD, like that, there's nothing really that's been consistent. Other than the usual suspects,
just all the
reducing
little things.
Stress level,
sleep. It's like, oh my goodness, the difference that sleep can make, or rather, the difference that lack of sleep can make.
Yeah, and I'm one who's like, chronically just over. Obviously, I'm doing podcasts of freaking.
I know. Actually, as I said it, I was like, oh my god, I should really let you go now because it is midnight. And I'm gonna start my day over here. Least,
so imagine this that. Yeah, true. I can't imagine if I was this sleep deprived and going into an office anyway. But
oh my brutal.
Yeah, nothing revolutionary yet. And I've talked to a few, doctors or whatever, but again, nothing revolutionary yet. So I'm not holding I'm not holding my breath for anything. And so it's just, it's just more of the usual suspects, I guess. And just finding more people. If you can surround yourself with more people who have it or can accommodate, just gravitate yourself towards them.
Yeah, exactly. And I do notice that even more so, I guess, partly because I work from home, but moving back to Cork, I mean, almost everyone that I hang out with knows the drill, and it is lovely, it does help. I do now.
But you worked hard to get there. I mean, it's not. I don't want to.
No, God, you
worked hard to get there. So, cool. Well, I want to. Let's end on that positive note. I'll probably cut some of this, my babblings out here. But
mine too, please.
I just want to say, I'll do the official, Claire, thanks for coming on the podcast. There's been a lot of great tips here. And, you kind of zoomed into a bunch of experiences at the office and at the home that I'm sure a lot of people can totally relate to. So
thank you so much for having me. It has been an absolute delight. And thank you so much for doing the podcast in general.
Thank you, Claire. One of the longer conversations, but worth every second. Season 3 interviews are almost all done being recorded, but do hit me up if you want to be on the show. I could squeeze in a few more, or we will get it all set up for season 4. If you're enjoying the shows, please consider hitting the 5 stars on Apple iTunes. If you don't like the show, feel free to rant on social media or send me feedback at hello@misappointedpodcast.com. Music, as always, is by Moby. And until next week, wishing you peace and quiet.